You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 3rd of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Israel struggles to extricate itself from self-inflicted PR nightmare. Is the West still wondering whether it really wants Ukraine to win? And Botswana threatens to invade Germany in a very specific fashion. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Caroline Frost and Sir Mark Lowcock will discuss the day's big stories, and our On This Day historical series will ponder the peculiar phenomenon by which an outlaw's reputation is enhanced by getting what was pretty clearly coming to him. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Caroline Frost, the writer, journalist and broadcaster, and by Sir Mark Lowcock, fellow of the Centre for Global Development and former head of humanitarian affairs at the UN. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello, Andrew.
As is vaguely traditional, we will start by catching up with the recent gallivanting of our guests. Mark, you have been in the Algarve.
I've been in the Western Algarve.
Is there a deadly postcode rivalry between Western and Eastern?
Oh, I normally go to Eastern Algarve, actually. So I'm trying to keep it a secret, the Eastern Algarve, Andrew, because it's such a fantastic place and almost no one other than Portuguese go there. But you've now outed my...
I know. What has occasioned this treachery? Why have you forsaken the East for the West?
How many Februarys and March have you spent in the home counties, Andrew? This is an alternative, an escape from the rainy, cloudy, grey misery of the southern counties.
Speaking of spending this part of the year in the home counties, Caroline.
Well, it's all relative, isn't it? The glamour from the Western Algarve to the West Witterings. So I've been down on the southern coast of England in a tiny, I call it a chalet. That's a little bit of an ambitious description, more of a shack, but certainly a room of one's own, as Virginia Woolf would say.
It has four walls and a roof.
What more does one need?
See, I basically wanted to talk about this just so I could say the phrase The Witterings, which is an excellent English place name. It sounds
yes.
like something somebody made up, possibly P.G. Woodhouse or Douglas Adams, but it is actually a place. It's a thing.
It is, and it's very aspirational. The West Witterings, similar to Mark's spot, definitely has a West-East rivalry. Certain very famous rock star and very famous A-list actress live in the West. I don't know of any quite similarly luminary people to live in the East. But what is interesting is that it's this charming little cut-off spot. The reason it's so cut-off is that there's one road into the peninsula. It's very much the insular peninsula, because once you're on that road, which is lovely at 4 o'clock in the morning in the summer, but hit 9 a.m. and you might as well, it's a string of family-sized cars that you can probably see from the moon, because you just sit on that road in and out. I think you're lucky if you get 10 minutes on the beach, glorious though it is.
Well, we will start with somewhere presently altogether less idyllic, i.e. the Middle East, and Israel is presently struggling with the public relations challenge occasioned by having blown up three cars full of aid workers. Seven staff attached to World Central Kitchen were killed yesterday in Gaza by an Israeli drone. Three of the dead were Britons, the other four respectively Australian, Polish, Palestinian and dual US Canadian. Israel has apologised for the deaths all the way up to President Isaac Herzog, and Israel has also promised an independent investigation. But the responses of the governments whose citizens died have been notably unimpressed. Caroline, first of all, they are not the first aid workers killed in Gaza these last 6 months. They are certainly very far from the first civilians killed in Gaza these last 6 months. Why do you think this particular incident has struck people as especially grotesque?
Interesting, isn't it? There's always a moment, isn't there, in all of these horrendous situations, whether it be military or humanitarian. I'm thinking of that poor, tragic baby washed up on the beach during the refugee crisis a few years ago. There's a picture that sticks in people's minds. In this particular story, this is because I think everyone relates to the idea of a chef working so hard to do so much good for so many people. He could be one of those unbearable celebrity chefs. We know that there is a surplus of them in the West, but instead, this wonderful man, José Yandrés, has put his money where his mouth is. He's taken his talent, his celebrity, his platform, he's taken it into a zone where most of us would instinctively run away from. And this is the price that has been paid by his hardworking people. They've put faces and names to these people. And I mean, the sad truth is that in the Western media, and I'll want to hear from Mark about the government, but it does seem as though these Western lives have got certainly a purchase on us. I don't want to say value, but certainly a purchase on our hearts and reflections that all of those innumerable Palestinians tragically do not.
Mark, also notable that the official response of Israel to this incident has been notably different to their response to previous, and they are abundant at this point, reports of deaths of aid workers, journalists, and just everyday civilians in Gaza. Israel is, I think, implicitly trying to spin this somewhat by saying, look, at least when we do something like this, we apologize and say we will investigate. The people we are fighting, by which they would refer to Hamas, most certainly do not. Is there really, though, any moral high ground to be claimed here?
Not much, I'm afraid. I mean, there have been 200 aid workers killed.
Indeed,
since Israel launched the military action after the Hamas atrocities. I think the characteristic that's caught the attention of these is there are three very British-looking former soldiers among them. And I think it's also attracted outrage because it exposes the fact that Israel has signally failed to do what belligerents almost always do in wars and conflicts, which is to create safe passage for humanitarian aid agencies. I used to be responsible when I was at the UN for a deconfliction system in Yemen at a time when the Saudi-led coalition were conducting a carpet bombing exercise year after year of Yemen. And they also wanted, though, to allow aid agencies to run hundreds of trucks a day to get food to the population. And so we in the aid system used to tell the Saudi military leadership in Riyadh, I used to go to their HQ in Riyadh and discuss this system, where every day we would tell them where the convoys were going. And they would make sure, and they had strong incentives for their American and British backers to do this, that they didn't bomb the aid convoys. And so it's very normal to put in place these deconfliction arrangements. They happened in Syria during the civil war as well. They're a very common thing. And the fact that Israel did not put in place an effective system for that has told everybody a lot about where this ranks in the priorities of the Israeli authorities. And that's one of the reasons why, together with the fact, the biggest reason, I'm afraid, is the particular characteristics of the people killed yesterday. But it's one of the reasons why it's attracted a lot of unhappiness.
Caroline, do we anticipate any either modification of Israel's own approach or perhaps modification of their allies towards them? It has been fairly obvious in the last few months of this action in particular that US President Joe Biden and I think the UK's Foreign Secretary Lord Cameron have been far, far more forthright in their rhetoric towards Israel than we usually see from American or British governments. Do you think that that might now actually be followed by, I guess, the kind of action that might force Israel to rethink its measures?
I agree with you that the rhetoric has been powerful on both sides of the House in the UK and over in America as well. But while they continue to sell arms and to recognise Israel as a, I mean, I guess, it, of course, it's a democratic country. We know that he's been, the leaders have been elected in Western accepted ways. But there's a sort of cognitive dissonance at the heart of certainly the British government, where they wring their hands. They say, yes, this needs to be transparently investigated. The Israelis have said this won't happen again. But to say, oh, this is all in, I think Rishi Sunak, our PM, called this intolerable, insufferable, what these deaths. But if you're providing arms to a government who are responsible either directly or indirectly, you're not really removing the gun from the battlefield, are you? I mean, until they, I guess, sort of move and to stop those arms, I mean, how can they really speak about this with any moral high ground at all.
Mark, just one final point on this I wanted to pick up on. And again, going back to your own expertise in dealing with humanitarian operations, since the deaths of these seven aid workers, we have seen statements from several other aid agencies saying they will suspend or wind down operations. We've seen at least one boat carrying much delivered aid turn around and head back for Cyprus. How do those decisions get made? I mean, I have reported from places where I have seen aid workers, NGOs doing extraordinary work in, incredible circumstances, not, far removed from what World Central Kitchen were doing in Gaza. But how do those conversations go on? Because obviously they're there doing vital work. They are feeding people who might not otherwise be fed. They are providing medicines which might not otherwise be administered. How do you decide we can't justify this risk? This is too dangerous. We need to get our people out.
Well, so the central judgment, the most important judgment, is whether you think the belligerents want to enable you to operate. So, for example, during the period of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, everybody knew that the aid agencies were not welcome. There was no negotiated access. If people tried to do things, they would be attacked and killed. Everybody knew that. Now, the situation in Gaza is not that, because it's not tolerable for Israel to say that to its Western allies. No aid agencies welcome here. So what I think will happen is this pause will be quite brief. Mm-hmm. The Israelis will set up the kind of system they should have set up months ago to create a bit more certainty for aid agencies.
Which, as you've said, is abundantly doable.
It's abundantly doable. It should have happened months ago. There's no excuse for it not happening. It requires a change of priorities on the Israeli side. And then people gradually will test things out. And the question will be whether, alongside that, what we get is a massive expansion in the current terrible dribble of aid. Because alongside what we've got now is 500 or more trucks waiting at the border to send enough aid in. That ship that was just turned around with the 200 tons of food that from World Kitchen that was about to be delivered to the beach of Gaza, 200 tons is a tiny proportion. You'd need 15 or 20 of those little rafts a day to deliver enough for 1 million tons of food a year for the population of Gaza. So the real question is whether this prompts not just a deconfliction system, but also an opening up of the borders to get enough aid in to stave off what is now a famine, killing more people, I think, now than the military activity itself.
Well, to Ukraine now, where Russia's 72-hour lightning conquest of the country is now in its 769th day. Valiant though Ukraine's continuing resistance is, it is not something that any country could do forever. And warnings from Ukraine's allies and gloating from Ukraine's ill-wishers are uniting around anticipation of a possible collapse of Ukraine's front lines, a scenario made all the more likely by the obstructions of the Yahoo caucus of the Republican Party in the US House of Representatives, who are continuing to withhold $60 billion worth of aid in the service of domestic politics. Caroline, these warnings are being echoed significantly by Ukraine's own president, Volodymyr Zelensky. Do we think that this is something he genuinely fears? I mean, I suppose there's no reason, as I ask that question, why he wouldn't. Or is he just trying yet again, as he has over the last 2 years, to stress the urgency of his country's predicament?
I mean, we know that he is a master of the comms, of the dramatic statement. And I would use the word stunt, but he's so admirable and courageous that I don't like to be a pejorative use of that word. But certainly when he turns up in London, he's been to America, he has shaken all the right hands. He must think, what do I have to do? It's now been 2 years. I can remember sitting here with you, actually, about 2 weeks in, and we were hoping that it would come to a very short and hopefully not too bloody end. And of course, we're sitting here 2 years later. Not only that, but it has slipped down the pecking order in terms of certainly media awareness and, of course, government awareness in the UK and the US. They not only have another conflict to deal with these powerful lobbies knocking at their door every day, but they also have elections in their backyard that I'm sure that they're not unaware of. So this does seem to have disappeared from the front of people's minds. He must just despair. I mean, the fact that the Ukrainian forces are still standing is a testament to their grit and resilience, because they are so horrendous tremendously outnumbered. But of course, Russia can afford just to watch that clock tick down. And I mean, it's people like Elon Musk coming out and saying, oh, it's all looking bad. It looks as though Odessa will fall. And certain, I mean, Elon Musk is one of those clocks that can be right twice a day. And it does look increasingly as though time is on the Russian side. I mean, it's a very, very sad situation to watch and to have all these other distractions going on. And yet it's become somewhat normalised, I think, in the media's world.
Well, this is what happens, though, Mark. I mean, I think things start to seem normal. We are both old enough, I suspect, to remember a time, and it really wasn't that long ago, when Europe sort of zoned out of a four-year-long siege of one of its own capital cities, somewhere actually much closer to most of Western Europe than the front lines of the Donbass are. Do you think, thinking along similar lines, quite a lot of Western publics and perhaps even some Western governments have sort of forgotten or ceased considering what the consequences of such a collapse of Ukraine's front lines might be?
I think European politicians are all now trying to acclimatise their populations to the need for more defence spending, to the fact that Russia is not the Russia that people thought it was. Western societies are not used to being threatened. They're not used to the prospect of conflict. Hardly any people are alive anymore who remember deep wars in which Western countries were existentially engaged. And societies have moved on. And I think that when it comes to Ukraine, there's still a lot of public support and good wishes and, desire for Ukraine to survive. And the question is whether that is turned fast enough into more economic support, more military support. And the position of the US is very important. I mean, if these stories that the Speaker of the House of Representatives is now going to turn his mind to releasing military support for Ukraine, if they turn out to be true, I think that would have a material effect. Otherwise, it's a bit of a race against time with Ukraine's defences increasing under pressure from a much bigger Russian army, which is better supplied with artillery shells and so on. So it's very difficult to predict the military prospects. It's easier to defend your own territory trying to save your families and friends than it is to attack someone else's territory. But the situation the Ukrainians face looks very difficult now.
Caroline, it's not just, in fairness, the US Republicans who are being odd about this. So is the incumbent administration to an extent. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, among others, kind of not happy about Ukraine conducting airstrikes against Russian infrastructure inside Russian territory, which in recent weeks Ukraine has been doing at, frankly, astounding range, hundreds of kilometres from their own borders. Why is America sort of wishing Ukraine wouldn't do that? Is that clear to you?
I can only speculate, but I do think that the Western world has sort of identified Ukraine as this, as I say, gritty and resilient, but a sort of a victim that they will seek to help. And for the Ukrainians to suddenly show their colours, I mean, it's admirable. As Marcus said, you can't just defend your country indefinitely because it's like a Masada sort of scenario where people will you will run out of everything you need and people will climb further and further up the hill. I can only speculate that they are not perhaps banging to the drum that the US have dictated. What would you say, Mark?
I think that the targets look as though they have a military relevance. I think that Ukraine has missiles which can get a long way, so they want to use them. And I think they're trying to do things to keep attention in the West on their problem and to try to convince the West that, in fact, Ukraine's problem is also a Western European problem. And I think there is a good understanding that now, especially in many of the countries of the Baltics, Poland, large parts of Germany and so on. But turning that into action to protect Ukraine in order to defend themselves is the thing that it's taking European politicians a long time to get their citizens' heads round.
Just finally on this, Mark, one idea that has been floated is this notion of outgoing NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg's idea. It's a 100 billion euro five-year fund, which would be ring-fenced for Ukraine. Now, it's fairly clear what Stoltenberg's underpinning thing is here. He wants to effectively Trump-proof aid to Ukraine, because this would be this would carry on regardless of whoever happens to be president of the United States. It is a fearful amount of money. Is this actually workable? Do you think there's been mixed views, I think it's fair to say, within NATO?
I think it's not that much money in the great scheme of things. For European taxpayers, this is completely affordable over a period of years. I think what it's about is to get the arms manufacturers, the missile builders and the artillery shell production lines to scale up their capacity on the basis that they'll get orders for several years. Because one of the things that's striking about the last 2 years is that the West has helped Ukraine by drawing down their own stocks and supplies, not by increasing production. And so I think a lot of what Stoltenberg is doing is to provide a boost to the industrial capacity. Putin, very observably and visibly, has turned his whole economy into a war economy. Their munitions and their arms productions are going through the roof, as well as what he's buying from North Korea and Iran and possibly other places as well. And I think what Stoltenberg's about is trying to get the, if you like, the industrial complex geared up to deter Putin, both in Ukraine, but also beyond Ukraine. Because I think European politicians are genuinely worried about the risk that if Putin wins in Ukraine, he won't be satisfied by that.
Well, let's move along to the first elephant-related threat to Europe since the Carthaginian phalanxes of Hannibal descended from the Alps. The president of Botswana, Mokgweetsi Masisi, has threatened to send 20,000 elephants to Germany. This is a response to Germany tightening rules on the import of hunting trophies, which will obviously deter German hunters with ambitions of returning from Botswana with a new umbrella stand. President Masisi's case, essentially, is that it is easy to regard elephants as noble and or adorable when you are not obliged to share a country with 130,000 of the bloody things, each of which eats 150 kilograms of vegetation every damn day, and that's before we get into all the stuff they knock over. Caroline, Botswana had previously, I noted researching this item, offered Hyde Park here in London 10,000 elephants. Should we take them?
I think that they might need a slightly larger park for that many animals. I'm not sure they've measured that park's
I think Hyde
perimeter.
Park would last approximately 72 hours.
Gosh. I think this is a story that possibly you can relate to, Andrew, more than the pair of us, because it's all about, so we sit here, don't we? I've been on safari. An elephant is a beautiful thing. But as you say, until you are surrounded by 130,000 of them and you are made aware of the local problems that they cause, they stop being quite so sweet. I'm thinking of you in your native land mm-hmm. with the kangaroo.
Indeed so. Well, I mean, this is a fair comparison. Foreigners are often aghast when they discover how many kangaroos are shot in Australia every year, partly because they are entirely edible, I'm able to mm-hmm. report, but also because they are a monstrous nuisance to agriculture and to farmers. There's also similar aghastness generated within Australia itself regarding what we call brumby hunting, brumbies being feral horses, which have been running wild in the Australian bush for years, which are shot from helicopters in large numbers because, again, they are an interrupter to the ecosystem and a general massive pest.
It is interesting, though, isn't it, that hearing all of that expertise, very admirable considering how long you've been away. It is, you sit here and you think of how shocking, how instinctively repelled I am when I see a picture of some white, rich, Western male, I hate to say it, but generally male. I think of the former premier of Spain, King Juan Carlos, and the fact all of those allegations of corruption and bribery and absolute abuse of power were nothing compared with the shocking picture of him with his trophy. I think that was what did for him. I think we all, I don't know what it is about, is it Brits? We all instinctively feel animals are nicer than people. And then when we hear a story like this, we think, oh, that really is shocking.
Because the British famously never went to Africa and blazed away at the wildlife.
But we do like our dogs. We do like our cats. Yeah. yes, I hear you.
Possibly worth noting, by way of further reinforcing your point, that somebody who has most definitely posed with elephants he paid vast amounts of money to shoot is Donald Trump Jr. It's always the ones you most expect,
isn't
it?
It's always the quiet ones.
Exactly. Does President Masisi, Mark, have a point here? Are we doing that thing of telling Africans how they should run Africa?
He absolutely has a point, doesn't he? I live near Richmond Park, Bushy Park. There's 650 deer mm-hmm. in those parks, and every year we kill about 100 of them because there are too many to be managed in the environment. We eat them as well, a bit like you and your... I can't remember, what was it called?
We don't eat the Brumbies. We do eat kangaroos. There are, of course, places in Europe where people eat horses with great enthusiasm.
Yes. So I think the Botswanans have a very good point. I think what gets people about this is what Caroline said about these majestic creatures being killed for fun. We all remember that Minnesotan dentist, Walter Palmer, 2015, mm-hmm. managed to get himself vilified around the world for shooting, having paid $50,000 for the privilege of doing so, Cecil the Zimbabwean lion. So that really annoys people. Mm-hmm. And then for reasons I think are a little bit irrational, we find it a bit annoying when countries like Botswana and Namibia want to manage their assets, as it were, sustainably by selling things you mm-hmm. get from them. You can buy the venison you get from shooting the deer in Bushy Park. Why is it so wrong? My old former friend Richard Leakey would have me hung, drawn and quartered from what I'm about to say. But why is it so wrong to get some benefit from the elephant population if there are too many to be absorbed in the environment?
See, Caroline, I do wish to make it clear to our listeners a couple of things. One, I am very much pro-elephant. Big fan. I have, as
Noted.
You have, I've done the safari thing in South yeah. Africa. I have seen it up close. If anybody has the wherewithal ever to do that, and for me, it was, to be very clear again, life as a freelance journalist, it was just one of those completely random travel assignments. Somebody just emailed me.
Gotta love a press trip.
Someone just said, would you like to go and spend 8 days in the South African veld with elephants? Yeah, sure, why not? And it is, it's absolutely extraordinary when you do see them mm-hmm. up close, however awe-inspiring you think that's going to be. It's more so. Also, I wish to make it clear that I struggle to think of a class of person weirder than those who do have the wherewithal to do that, clearly, who would spend that amount of money to fly to Africa and shoot one. Aside from anything else, hitting an elephant with a rifle, not one of the great feats of marksmanship from pretty much any distance. But are we too judgmental of schemes like this just because, Caroline, we think the people who do it are massive weirdos?
Oh, you mean the...
The hunters.
The
yes.
hunters. Well, I mean, I think that you have to be the sum of your judgments, don't you? I think people at this day and age, I was talking to somebody about this at the weekend, we were saying, everyone says, oh, I don't want to be judgmental. And I say, why not? That's how we register our own moral agency, isn't it? What we judge and what we find fair and unfair. I think the gap here is between understanding that, yes, locals know their habitat far better than we do, and that I thought that we were nearly at the stage where we sort of put the white man's burden to bed, and we do integrate with communities all over the world much more intelligently and compassionately than we used to. And then you hear that, oh, we're hunting, you know, this is getting in the way of all of our fun. But I think it comes down to the lack of humaneness. I'm happy to call them weirdos. I think there are worse names for that. I think as if you had $50,000 to spare, the idea that that would be you would consider that to be a good use of your disposable cash is very questionable.
Well, now to the moon, a jurisdiction rarely considered in these symposiums on the grounds that little happens there. As news beats go, it's basically Belgium, but with even worse scenery. However, boffins at NASA have been directed to create a standard time zone for the moon. This maybe doesn't seem that complicated, like just pick a time zone and put the moon in it, not like anybody there is going to complain, but it turns out it actually is, as it will be intimately involved with the calibration of spacecraft and satellites, and also it says here time moves differently on the moon, something to do with gravity. Could not say I entirely followed it. Mark, what time zone do you think the moon should be in? Come on, name one.
I couldn't understand the question, never mind the answers I read to that. So here's my test of whether I'm willing to sign up for this exploration. Are the beaches better than Bali? Are the game parks better than Zambia? Are the golf courses better than South Carolina? Tick yes on any of those and okay, it's on my bucket list. Otherwise, I'm going to stick with encouraging the scientists. I do see the scientists are planning to grow cress and brassica, which is, as I understand it, broccoli, basically, on the moon. And good luck to them. Please report back to me. In the meantime, I'm going to keep growing my broccoli in the vegetable patch in Chestnut Avenue.
See, I have had the immense privilege of speaking to somebody who has actually been to the moon, the great Charlie Duke, who I think was the 10th man to walk on the moon, who I interviewed for Monocle a few years ago. He was Capcom as well on Apollo 11. He spoke quite fondly of it, Caroline, but I guess that's been the basis for his entire life ever since.
It served him well.
It has served him well, and fair play as well. Couldn't have met a nicer fellow, honestly. Mm-hmm. But obviously, this is all part of the ramping up towards sending US astronauts back in 2026 with their miniature greenhouses in which they're going to grow lunar broccoli. Will you be staying up all night to watch the giant leap reenacted?
Oh, 120%. I've met Charlie Duke. I met Gene Kernan.
Is there anybody he hasn't met?
No, he's met all of us.
Mark, have you met Charlie Duke?
I have never met an astronaut.
Oh, you lose.
So Gene Kernan, who was the last man on the moon, 72, I said, that whole thing with the Apollo landing and Neil Armstrong, I said, how did it, you know, he did that last bit without any comms and it was running out of fuel. Can you imagine the sang-froid of the man? And he was so cool. He just said, oh, Neil knew what any teenage American boy knows. When you're on a mission, there's always a tiny bit more fuel in the tank.
Mark, the idea as well, other than growing broccoli on the moon, and it is, they're not just doing that. It would be a long way to, but that said, it was a long way to go to play golf, and they did that. But the idea is that there will be permanent bases on the moon, doubtless one named after Charlie Duke at some point, and then there will be a subsequent mission to Mars. Would that entice you any more than the moon?
I'm not in for any of these, but I am very strongly in favour of people who want to do it and pursue the boundaries of scientific exploration. I mean, that is how we grow and develop and learn new things, and I'll be sitting next to Caroline on the sofa cheering them on when it's televised.
And Caroline, are you looking forward to finding out how many people on social media will claim it's a hoax even while it's actually occurring?
Can't wait.
Because that will be a non-zero number.
It will be slightly larger than zero.
It will. Caroline Frost and Sir Mark Lowcock, thank you both for joining us. And finally on today's show, our On This Day historical series wonders if the legend of one American outlaw would have proved quite so enduring if his life hadn't been so short. Jesse James's plans for April 3rd, 1882 were not unusual, at least not for Jesse James. He and his associates were to meet at his house at 1318 Lafayette Street in St. Joseph, Missouri, and proceed to Platte City, about 30 miles away, with a view to robbing the bank. James needed a result. The previous few years had caused him to wonder about the long-term prospects of life as the United States' most famous outlaw. The legendary posse, the James Younger Gang, with which he had most profitably plundered the banks, trains, and stagecoaches of perhaps 11 states, had been reduced by mishap and justice to Jesse and his older brother Frank. But with the aid of a couple of relatively recent recruits, the Ford brothers, Robert and Charlie, Jesse and Frank had hopes of riding again. Keep on riding, riding, riding. Frank and Jesse. The Ford brothers may not have known precisely how much loot lay in the vaults of the Platte City Bank. They did know, for it had been in the newspapers, the precise bounty that Missouri's governor, Thomas Crittenden, had put on Jesse James's head, $10,000. There have been uncountable depictions in film, literature, and song of what happened when Jesse James turned his back on Robert Ford to clean a dusty picture frame. This one is from 1986's The Last Days of Frank and Jesse James, in which Jesse is played by Kris Kristofferson, Frank by Johnny Cash.
Picture sure looks dusty.
Jesse! Jesse!
Pick it up, Mr. Cash.
Jesse James was a man with blood on his hands.
James was 34 when Robert Ford shot him. His legend, already considerable, would be exponentially engorged by the earliness of his death and the manner of it. Little engenders sympathy like betrayal and martyrdom. By way of contrast, the Ford brothers, whose vanquishing of a dangerous criminal may have been the only vaguely public-spirited act of their wretched lives, were damned for eternity by judges up to and including Bruce Springsteen.
Well, it was Robert Ford, that dirty little coward.
Jesse James bathes still in sentimental luster, mythologized as an American Robin Hood, however little evidence there is to support any inclination he had towards giving to the poor what he had taken from the rich. Aside from Kris Kristofferson, the long list of matinee idols who have portrayed Jesse James on screen includes Tyrone Power.
Keep right on driving until I tell you to stop. What are you aiming to do, partner?
I ain't aiming to do nothing. I'm doing it. I'm holding up this train.
Brad Pitt.
Get down on your knees.
Why?
You ought to pray. I'm going to kill you.
And the genuinely valiant Audie Murphy, who launched a Hollywood career after returning from World War II, the most decorated soldier in American history. Quite the contrast with the James brothers' squalid service during the US Civil War with unruly pro-Confederate guerrilla militias.
Your men are shooting unarmed civilians.
If you don't like the way we're fighting the war, Mr. James, tell Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Anderson's dead. I just killed him.
Jesse James was alive.
Jesse James is not the only villain to have been recast by the collective consciousness and popular culture as some species of hero, one of those dreadful ne'er-do-wells romanticised in safe retrospect. We would probably take a less forgiving view if they were presently rampaging through our town, bailing up our wagon or looting our portmanteaus at pistol point. One might think of Australia's Ned Kelly or Britain's Dick Turpin, both of whom also died young, though in both their cases at the end of the rope which Jesse James was spared by Robert Ford's treachery on this day 142 years ago.
Jesse James, he promised, I will never die afraid.
It may be arguable that the worst punishment we can inflict on such rogues is to let them live. Frank James survived till he was 72. After somehow escaping conviction for any of his many crimes, he was unable to convert his outlaw CV to occupations any more glamorous than shoe salesman, fruit picker, telegraph operator, and booth attendant at a St. Louis theatre, which advertised the opportunity to come and get your ticket punched by the legendary Frank James. Respectable work, to be sure, but nobody ever wrote a song about him. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Caroline Frost and Sir Mark Lowcock. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.